Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we are strapping on our tool belts for a journey back to the 1990s UK high street.
We're stepping behind the counter of a small, independent hardware shop, one that's fighting, well, a war of attrition for its very existence.
And our source material for this deep dive is the witty, semi-autobiographical memoir by Graham Hickson titled How Much for a Little Screw? Tales from Behind the Counter.
You know, this book is so much more than just a collection of funny anecdotes. It's really an emotional archive of what the author calls an almost extinct species, the local hardware man.
Right.
He drops us right into this blustery cast of oddball but genuinely decent characters who are facing the slow, grinding death of their way of life.
But we aren't just here for the nostalgia, are we?
Absolutely not.
The mission today is to unpack the two catastrophic forces that were just systematically hammering independent retailers across the UK in that era.
Yeah, on one side, you have the merciless rise of corporate big box stores, just pure capital efficiency.
And on the other, you have these sudden, seismic, and frankly, often predatory shifts in institutional banking practices.
And we want to understand what it took, the determination, the diversification, and I mean, the sheer human optimism to cope with failure when the forces stacked against you were this immense and this coordinated.
This isn't just a story about a shop. It's a blueprint for surviving existential economic pressure. So let's unpack this. Okay, let's start with the immediate and, you know, the most visible threat.
For the proprietor, the constant looming dread was embodied by one phrase: the bloody sheds.
The bloody sheds. Now, for anyone unfamiliar, that was the technical trade term for the massive out-of-town DIY superstores.
Right. Think of the massive home improvement chains. In the 90s, they were just systematically blitzing the independents.
And the book really explains why this was such a David and Goliath situation, doesn't it?
It does. The independent shop is described as minute. It's sandwiched between other high street businesses.
So expansion is just impossible.
Totally impossible. You can't compete on floor space or volume or selection. And the author notes with this real bitterness that while the sheds claim to have lower prices, well, he says, they lied and they got away with it.
But if they were lying about the price, how did they win? It had to be about more than just scale, you know?
It was about visibility and convenience. They offered a one-stop experience.
Okay.
Initially, the independent hardware man had a small window for survival, and that was specialization.
Right. They excelled at sourcing the rarer gems.
The things the big boxes couldn't or wouldn't bother with. We're talking specialized light bulbs for imported fittings. Or a truly awkward, tricky toilet seat fitting that you needed to make up for, as he puts it, deficiencies at the lights of B&Q at all.
So they're providing the expert solution for the corporate leftover problem, but that's a dangerous model.
It is. A very dangerous model. They generated goodwill, sure, and they provided an essential community service, but they faced this constant bitter realization.
Which was?
A new customer might come in desperate for that one specific screw or that light switch, but they almost always return to the multiples for the bigger ticket items.
The expensive tools, the paint, the new doors.
Exactly. So the sheds were building market share and high visibility, while the little independent shop was just servicing high margin, low volume emergencies.
And just as they're struggling to contain this corporate warfare, the financial floor just drops out from beneath them.
Yes. The second, and I'd say more brutal, hammer blow came from the bank.
This is where we see systemic change, and it's enacted with just ruthless efficiency.
Well, the protagonist had maintained an 8-year overdraft facility of £22,000. It was secured against the shop property itself.
A foundation of financial certainty.
It was. And then, without any warning, a new, young management team was installed at the branch, and they called in the entire facility.
Just like that. What was the rationale? Why suddenly liquidate a long-standing, secured business relationship?
Their rationale was chillingly corporate. Overdrafts, they claimed, were antiquated practices that ran on unprofitable familiar lines.
So this secured facility, which gave the business vital liquidity, a buffer,
was to be immediately restructured and treated as an overnight loan.
Okay, let's stop there because this is a crucial piece of knowledge for you, the listener. What's the practical difference between a long-term secured overdraft and an overnight loan in terms of business stability?
The difference is everything. I mean, an 8-year secured overdraft allows a small business to manage cash flow troughs. You can buy stock in bulk, survive the slow season, pay an unexpected bill.
Right, with the confidence that the money is available.
Yes. But when a bank suddenly reclassifies that as an overnight loan, it means the business has to pay back the entire £22,000 immediately or risk foreclosure.
They lose all financial certainty.
They're instantly forced into fatal asset sales or liquidation. The bank literally took away their oxygen.
And this wasn't just an isolated incident affecting one shop.
No, the neighboring chip shop owner, Adrian Fryer, he had his loan canceled just like that. Which raises the critical question asked by Sharon in the book.
Were the banks trying to close the whole bleeding town?
And the answer, shockingly, was, well, yes, or at least they were facilitating it.
How so?
The accountant, who steps in to manage the financial fallout, she uncovers the smoking gun. A shocking development plot.
The plot.
The bank's actions were directly tied to a company called XYZ Developments. And there was a proposed site of development linked back to the branch management, which was intended specifically to demolish the town center where the shop stood.
So this wasn't just poor business practice or market forces alone. This was a calculated, coordinated effort.
Between finance and property developers.
Yeah.
To clear the high street for a more profitable land use. The existential threat wasn't just competition. It was literally a plan for demolition.
The forces outside were clearly brutal, but the story shows that surviving a coordinated attack like this, it hinges on the people inside.
Yeah, so who exactly was fighting this war from behind the counter?
Well, we have a stellar cast. There's the narrator, and then there's Sharon. She's witty, streetwise, a former actress and market trader.
The emotional anchor and the chief strategist for sarcasm.
Exactly. She was even the protagonist's remote alarm clock, using her theatrical skills, which she describes as BAFTA winning, to wake him up remotely every single morning.
And then there's the MD, the contrary old man. He kind of embodies the outdated ethos they're trying to escape.
He was pathologically obsessed with goodwill and antiquated practices.
And believed in constructing these crude, Heath Robinson-type anti-theft contraptions rather than, you know, hiring proper staff.
I have to pause on that. For our international listeners, when the source describes something as Heath Robinson-type, it refers to the British cartoonist. He was known for drawing these incredibly complex, absurd mechanical devices to do a very simple task.
It's the perfect visual for the MD's approach to modern retail.
Yeah.
And he was completely out of touch with reality. He'd constantly proclaimed that scores of them were queuing down to the post office to spend their money.
Only for the narrator to open the till at the end of the day and find what? A tenner.
It's just a tenner.
But the insight there is important. Why this reliance on homemade contraptions and goodwill?
Because the small independent shop owner of that era was substituting cheap or, you know, free family labor and personal dedication for the expensive professional staff and security systems the sheds could afford.
His goodwill was his currency.
A currency that was rapidly devaluing against corporate logistics and standardized pricing. He was basically hiding the true labor costs of the operation.
The anecdotes in the book just capture this world perfectly.
They do. Sharon uses these amazing analogies like alien grooming rituals when she's comforting a distraught shoplifter.
And the customer requests are pure gold. They capture the strange intimacy of high street life.
Oh, beyond the title reference, the inevitable customer asking, how much for a little screw? You have genuinely bizarre requests.
Like what?
Customers asking the MD to fettle 3 pairs of rusty garden shears. Or, the classic, where customers would ask Sharon, can I see what knockers you've got?
Referring naturally to door hardware.
Of course.
Yeah.
But it allowed for a great piece of high street banter.
And this leads us to the iconic character of Sergeant Major Jim, the screw thief.
Sergeant Major Jim. He was the picture of the old school customer. Religiously bought loose screws in dozens using paper bags, always engaging in these long, pointless conversations about the quality of brass.
The lifeblood of the high street, you'd think.
You would. Only later did they discover he was the shoplifter. He was fencing the screws and other small hardware at a local car boot sale, which for our American listeners is basically a flea market held out of the back of cars.
And the reason for this crime, it wasn't simple poverty, was it?
No, it was this bizarre, intensely personal vendetta. He was driven to petty theft because the MD had once, years ago, condemned the quality of his late loved one's garden shears.
Wow.
It just shows how incredibly personal and sometimes toxic retail relationships were back then. Everything was tied to memory and perceived insult, unlike the sterile anonymous transaction at the sheds.
All this pressure, it eventually cracks the foundation of the old ways. The MD, the very embodiment of these antiquated practices, he starts to crumble.
He does. He reduces his workload to 2 days a week, and he excludes the crucial Saturday rush, claiming he needs time to go shopping with his wife.
Which is really the symbolic end of that era of total lifelong commitment.
He eventually resigns. After 54 years in the trade, and with the old guard gone and the bank's threat looming large, the accountant's strategy shifts from firefighting to existential planning.
The business needs cuts, and most crucially, diversification.
And the accountant, she gets very specific. She wants them to eliminate the grudge buys.
The grudge buys? What are those?
They're the ancient miscellaneous stock items, the things that have been sitting on the shelf for a decade, gathering dust. They're dead capital.
Right.
While they might represent history, they're tying up cash that could be used for rapid turnover. And that's critical when you're managing the financial crunch of an overnight loan status. Cash flow is now paramount.
And this need for diversification leads to the most surprising and frankly hilarious suggestion.
That they should diversify into ladies' underwear, lingerie, to fill a niche left vacant by other high street closures.
They actually take it seriously enough to go on a scouting trip to an exhibition.
And Sharon, naturally, is ecstatic. She's running the owner's fingers over the sheer materials, enthusiastically concluding the shop needed a nice light carpet and a dedicated measuring area.
Where the keyhole, their clunky key-cutting station, currently stood.
Exactly. This shift from the functional, hard, mechanical world of hardware to the soft, intimate world of lingerie. It must have felt like an existential threat to the owner's identity.
It was a crisis of manhood, really.
You can see it. The protagonist firmly dismisses the idea as software, not hardware. His whole identity is tied up in the metal, the wood, the problem-solving of fittings.
Selling foundation garments felt like a betrayal of the trade.
But the fact they even considered it shows the level of desperation they'd reached.
Meanwhile, they try to modernize by hiring Greville, the young apprentice.
And the MD's contradictory nature shines through. He publicly resents this new blood coming in to change his shop, but then he secretly tries to curry favor with them. He even promises to teach Greville how to pick locks.
Greville is a walking disaster area, though.
He is. But he provides some necessary comic relief, which just underscores the high stress levels. You get these great physical gags. He confuses stealth for shelf, thinks Bassine, a type of brush fiber, is a sink. Or he's constantly creating danger with exploding soft furnishings.
It just highlights the difficulty of integrating fresh, untrained labor into a system run entirely on bespoke, decades-old knowledge.
And all this internal struggle is set against the larger political backdrop. The shopkeepers knew that the proposed parking charges would be the final fatal blow.
They would turn off the tap of footfall.
They fought it. They packed a public meeting, voted overwhelmingly against the charges. The community did not want the change.
But the council, mirroring the top-down corporate coldness of the bank, just ignored the democratic mandate entirely.
They did. The charges went through, and it resulted in an immediate, massive downturn in sales. The local government essentially finished the demolition job that the bank started.
With sales tanking and the bank demanding payment, the narrator is forced into the one type of work he dreaded the most.
External handyman jobs. At people's houses. He explicitly hates it. The shop owner holds a higher status in the community. They're the stable anchor, the resource.
Becoming a mobile service worker means admitting the anchor has dragged.
Exactly. And the jobs he takes on are just wonderfully strange. There's the electrical socket at a place called The Lodge that was saturated in dog urine.
Which he replaces and charges for.
And then there's the high-stakes rescue of a woman named Jill who's locked in her bathroom.
The Jill anecdote is a perfect contrast between their old-school skill and the new-school ripoff culture, isn't it?
It really is. The lock was complex, but instead of drilling it out, which an expensive modern locksmith would have charged a fortune for, he just used a lubricant in precision.
He saves the day with honesty and skill. It demonstrates the value that was being lost to the high street.
And this honesty is mirrored by a completely unexpected lifeline. Amidst all the calculation and hostility from the bank, a mysterious, untraceable loan of £2,500 arrives.
In a plain brown envelope labeled simply, a loan.
It's a moment that just needs to breathe. He immediately uses it to stave off the bank for another cycle.
This anonymous act of support stands in such direct, stunning contrast to the calculated eviction attempt by the financial institutions.
It suggests that even if the high street was being destroyed, the spirit of community still existed, operating outside the official channels of capital.
And the story reaches its final act with the return of the MD after his long absence.
He has this startling moment of unexpected optimism, and he reflects on his own outdated beliefs.
He utters what he thought was an unquestionable truth. Banks don't go bust. The likes of us go bust, not banks.
Right before he corrects himself with a moment of startling prophecy, he immediately asserts, they will. They can topple over just like anyone else. It'll happen someday.
Which, given the banking crises that would follow in the coming decades, is a chillingly accurate premonition of corporate fragility.
It really is. And his final unifying piece of advice is simple. Embrace the change. We'll sell ladies' underwear if we have to.
The shop decides to focus on the future, resilient, even finding humor in the terrible, badly bent U-bend Christmas tree the town council supplied that year.
What a fantastic journey.
Yeah.
I mean, into a very specific and yet universally relatable corner of British retail history.
We've covered the dramatic pressure points, bank foreclosure, ruthless corporate warfare, local government sabotage, and seen the deep human resilience embodied by this eccentric team. The crucial takeaway for you, our listener, is in understanding the clash of perspectives we've documented here. The bank saw the protagonist's overdraft through a cold, purely data-driven profitability lens. It was just a line to be cut.
Whereas the community and the protagonist saw that same financial instrument as a necessary emotional investment in a stable local service.
And the chasm between those two viewpoints resulted in the tragic decimation of the high street.
This whole story is fundamentally about rapid, sometimes toxic change versus stagnation and tradition. And that brings us to our final thought.
Throughout the book, the protagonist frequently noticed one particular character, a man who waited at the same bus stop every single day for almost 10 years.
And when the protagonist finally, after a decade of observation, offered him a lift, the man revealed he wasn't waiting for a bus at all. He was merely standing there because he had nowhere else to go.
So what does that character, standing motionless for a decade amidst all the upheaval, the shed construction, the bank foreclosures, the parking charges, what does he ultimately represent?
Is he the symbol of the forgotten anchor, the human cost of the high street's collapse? Or is he simply an immutable fixture, proving that even the most dizzying economic change can fail to shift some things?
Something to mull over as you walk down your own local high street until our next deep dive.